Chapter 19. Argonis. The armada that would break the cradle of mankind arrived the way rain starts after a season of drought. First a single drop falling from an iron sky to touch dry ground, then a second, and then the deluge pouring from heaven without end. Ships came from the warp, churning reality to ragged froth as they cut back into being, adding to the might of those already gathered above Ullinor. The first of the new arrivals came in midnight clad, their gun towers snarling with dirty gold leers, their hulls cobwebbed by silver lightning bolts. The Covenant of Blood, the Excoriator, and the Echo of Damnation drifted from their translation points, wary and sullen. Others followed. Clusters of craft from every legion that had pledged to Horus's cause, and more besides. Ships in unknown liveries and bearing strange names slid from the night like rough beasts called from the edge of the world. The Cradle of Light, bearing the Brotherhood of Scorn, the Sepulchral Sword, and the Song of the Unliving, marked with the heraldry of 7 different legions. On came the mongrel children of strife, and with them came ships crewed by mortals, thousands of them, from schools of strike frigates to the gigantic cannon barge Mithras, all of them responding to the War Master's call. From the strategium of the Iron Blood, Perturabo watched each of them appear on the fleet's sensor mesh, and then issued the order that moved them into place in the spheres above Ullinor. Guns tracked each arrival, their command slaved to the will of the Lord of Iron. Signals greeted the new ships, confirming loyalty, ship condition, and troop strength. Perturabo, Grand High Marshal to the War Master, saw and held each set of data, slotting it into the scheme forming in his mind. The title that he now bore mattered little beside the reality that he was creating. Every scrap of strength and materiel extended along an axis into the future, sliding into models and plans as they were matched against Dawn's solar defenses. In his soul, the values of destruction spun and danced and created a beauty that only he would ever see. When the flow of arrivals had slackened, the duty would pass to Forex, with Sultan Vul, Bronn, and Barossus to aid him. Even then, the data arrangement would be almost overwhelming. To the Lord of Iron, it was a song that he was only now being allowed to bring into being. Shuttles and landing ships passed from the ships to the planet's surface without cease. Each moved only when ordained and authorized, watched by the overlapping guns of Iron Warriors and Sons of Horus warships. They descended through an unsullied atmosphere. The clouds had been salted with crystals to clear the skies above the Imperial dais and the victory parade. Sunlight and starlight touched the white marble of the dais for the first time in years. Closer to the ground, the shuttles and landing craft swirled in stacked flights. Black-winged interceptors slid amongst them, weapons armed and sensors watching. One by one, they dropped to the ground. Plumes of dust rose from the drying earth as thrusters fired. Hundreds of thousands of warriors and tens of thousands of war machines already carpeted the planet. A city of landing craft covered the triumphal plateau. Roads of segmented metal covered the ground between the machines. Slave battalions and mechanical machines moved between the craft under the direction of Iron Warriors, and squads of Sons of Horus watched from towers of welded girders. Every legion and faction held its own quarter. Great reaches divided by avenues of flame-topped pillars. A great pavilion of gilded plates and multicoloured silk had unfolded from the dropship that housed Fulgrim's Court of Pleasure. A sweet, glistening fog hung above it, and a swelling of screams and laughter rose to meet the roar of thrusters and the clank of machines. The camp of the Word-Bearers shone with flames beneath the red and black hulls of their temple craft. A forest of impaled humans rose amongst them, and black smoke breathed into the air from fire pits. The landing craft of the Titan legions loomed above the rest, blackened cliffs of metal from which the god machines would walk. Only the World Eaters were held in orbit, and would be until the last hours of the muster. To do anything else risked slaughter. Even then, there had been skirmishes between some forces. Blood had blessed the soil of Alanor, and some forces had been decimated as punishment and example. The corpses and fire-gutted shells of armor lined the wide avenues that converged on the parade and dais. And still more came from the sky to join those on the ground. At the Triumph a decade and a half before, it had taken months for the Mechanicum to prepare the ground, and weeks to array the forces that took part. Perturabo had bent his mind and will to see this mustering complete in less than 14 days. So far, his timetable had been followed to the minute. On the surface, Argonis watched from the dais as the lights of the landing craft chased the setting sun beneath the horizon. They had kept coming until Perturabo relinquished his control of the marshalling and descended to the surface to stand with his brothers. They stood as they had decades before, high on the imperial dais, Perturabo beside Magnus, the two separating Angron and Fulgrim. The air wept red around the world-eater's Primarch, and his head twitched like a starved dog. Fulgrim grinned his needle smile, and his laughs of delight tore at the souls of warriors passing within earshot. The marble they stood upon had been blasted white, the statues anointed in blood, and the symbols of the Pantheon fluttered on the wind beside the banners of the nine legions that would make the new Imperium. Beneath them, a river of flesh and iron had marched, their shouts of salute and praise a rolling roar of voices blending with the blare of war horns and the clatter of machines. They began as dark fell, burning brands in their hands, flame and sparks streaming from great cages of coals set on the backs of titans. On they came, through growing twilight and into the night, passing under the eyes of the lords of the new Imperium, until just before dawn, the sons of Horus came. The rising sun glinted off the eye of Horus, set on shoulders and borne on banners, and the great cry came from the warriors as they passed the dais.
Lupercal! Imperator! Lupercal!
On and on, louder and louder, and as they had passed, Horus had raised Worldbreaker, and silence had echoed before the sea of warriors and war engines had given single voice to a cry that rose and rose, as though to shake the stars in the firmament. They were all there, all the great and small who defied the tyranny of the false emperor of mankind. Even sons of the Night Haunter had responded to the call, and with the arrival of the Crimson King, all of the defiant legions were represented. All except one. The warriors of the Alpha Legion were nowhere to be seen. Alpharius had been there, though, waiting at the edge of the great turning of events like a phantom at a feast. The Emperor's children and word-bearers had told Horus of the figure they had seen, and Argonis had watched his lord nod, then look up to an empty point in the distance.
"He will come when he is ready," the War Master had said.
And that night, on the eve of the parade of forces, Alpharius had come. He came alone. No one saw him until he was on the threshold of the chamber in the dais that Horus had made his council room. It had been Malkador's in the days before the first triumph, and the imperial eagles still glowered from amongst the eye-marked banners. Argonis, attending on his master, watched as the Justerian snapped into sudden action, guns rising, chain and power blades screaming to life.
"Hold,"
Horus said, without looking away from the spinning hololith of the solar system projected in the center of the room.
"Let him pass."
Alpharius walked forwards and stopped a pace from Horus. The only weapon he bore was a sheathed dagger at his waist, the grip fashioned in the shape of two intertwined snakes. Scales covered his armor, glinting iridescent blue, and a helm with a low crest hid his face. He did not remove it.
"You bring me no warriors, brother. They did not perish at the gates of Terra, and yet they are not here. So what do you come to lay at your war master's feet?"
Alpharius did not reply, but simply took a small black and brass cylinder from a recess in his armor. Data sockets gleamed at either end of the rod. Alpharius held it out. Horus looked at him, his focus bleeding out into the air around him. Argonis winced at the pressure in his skull. Horus gestured, and Argonis stepped forward to take the data cylinder. Alpharius held up his free hand, and the gesture was somehow enough to freeze Argonis in mid-stride. Horus and Alpharius remained still, looking at each other, the master of serpents seeming small beneath the undiluted focus of the Warmaster. Argonis wondered how anything could remain still under that gaze. Then, slowly, without breaking his focus, Horus reached out and took the cylinder. Alpharius nodded. Horus tossed it to Argonis, who slotted it into an isolated cogitator. Cogs clattered, disks of silver spun, and then cones of hololight unfolded in the air. First came the great body of the sun, and then its planets, each blooming to dominate the view before shrinking as their siblings were added. Moons, orbital habitats, drifts of void stations and fortresses glimmered into view. Data shone in halos around them, flowing with strength specifications, tactical weaknesses and threat reaction parameters. Argonis recognized the image. It was a strategic view of the solar system, but threaded and woven with information on every detail of its defenses, from communication response times to main troop strengths. It was staggering. A treasure of intelligence from the heart of Rogel Dawn's fortress. Horus did not look at it, as though he had known what Alpharius would bring.
"You have my thanks," said Horus.
Behind him, the projection of the solar system spun, its secrets unfolding like flowers in sunlight.
"You have done as I asked, but come alone. Where is your legion?"
Alpharius did not move for a long moment. Reflections of the display flowed across the green lenses of his helm. Then he drew the knife from his waist. The motion was simple. Not a grand flourishing or threat-filled flash, but still the Justerin twitched. Horus did not move. Alpharius held the dagger up. It was long and double-edged. Twin serpents were etched on the blade to match the grip, one coiling towards the hilt, one towards the tip. Alpharius held it still for a second, then reached up with his other hand. He gripped the blade. Razor edges bit into ceramite. Argonis realized what he was going to do an instant before the blade shattered in Alpharius's grasp. He opened his hand, and slivers of metal fell between the fingers like sharp petals of a crushed rose. Then he dropped the dagger's hilt at Horus's feet, turned, and walked towards the door. The Justerin moved to stop him, but Horus gave a small shake of his head.
"No," he said. "Let him go."
Argonis looked back from the image of Alpharius to the broken dagger and the mirror coin lying on the stone floor. He had thought of Echidon then, the conversation he'd had with the Mournival after Horus had summoned him. Abaddon had been there, returned from his hounding of the wolves, the Red Angel a fire-wreathed shadow at his back. The others, Aximand, Kyber, and Tormageddon, had formed an arc around him, watching. Abaddon had spoken first.
"I oppose the choice of you," said Abaddon,
as he turned to look at him squarely.
"Just so that you know."
Argonis held his gaze for a second and then shook his head.
"My thanks for the clarification first, Captain."
Abaddon's mouth thinned.
"The Warmaster requires an equerry," Tormageddon said. "He sent us to summon you, and we took the opportunity to..."
"There is a matter that needs dealing with,"
Aximand said, his voice flat, his eyes fixed on the distance.
"A matter that the Warmaster cannot address, and has forbade us to. And so you must address for him, Lord Equerry."
The words that came after had followed him into his audience with the Warmaster, and turned through his mind as he looked at Alpharius's broken and discarded dagger, and rose again now as he heard the roar of the armies that would burn terror. Once they were gone, the pyres would be lit, and one-tenth of the slave strength of all the legions would be burned alive on this spot. It would be an offering, a libation to the gods at the commencement of the last great battle for mankind. He thought of the symbol he now bore atop an iron staff, not as an emissary, but as the voice of the War Master. He thought of the deeds he would have to do, of the first deed he would have to do. He thought of Chthonia, long ago, but still remembered, of his blood brothers and the flash of a grin behind a knife as they ran to make murder. He thought of Volk looking at him on a smoke and mist street dawn on the side of a mountain, far away now.
The end was only a dream. And what do dreams matter?
Argonis waited for the shouts of exhortation to fade, and then walked away from the view into the shadow of marble corridors and the ghosts of his own thoughts. Lyak. Lyak looked up as the wind brought the scent of the pyres to his nose. The light of the Armada filled his mask helm's eyes. There were cruisers, destroyers, bombardment barks, macro carriers, battle barges, cities of stone and iron filled with tens of thousands of souls. The flames of those souls outlined the craft, illuminating them in the sight of his mask. They slid across Alanor's sky, seeming to streak through the heavens, even though they were still, tethered to stationary orbit.
"What do you see?"
said a voice from behind him. Hebeck shifted posture, hand going to his sword like a dog raising its hackles.
"Lady Actea," he said without looking around, "you bless and honour me with your presence."
He turned. She stood two paces behind him, hands by her sides, the aching roar of her psychic aura dimmed as though it were a fire in need of fuel. The wind caught her robe, and she pulled the blood-crusted velvet closer. She had her face turned upwards towards the now clear sky, and the night laid out across it. He followed the line of her attention, and found the ships of the Emperor's children. They sparkled with the light of souls flaring in pain, and then snuffing out, the tithe in suffering and lives to keep their Primarch prince in the abyss of the real.
"You did not go with Lord Aurelian," he said.
"Self-evidently true," she said,
then cocked her head to the side, blind eyes fixed on nothing.
"Well, are you going to tell me what you see? Or am I just going to have to imagine it?"
He shook his head.
"You ask the question because you want me to ask it of you."
She smiled, the expression cold.
"A fair point."
She paused.
"Well, aren't you going to ask?
It is the question you have wanted to ask since you made your choice."
Lyak shook his head and looked away across the pyre-dotted plateau. 8 days of sacrifice and flame had burned the clouds away and laced the ground with greasy ash.
"What do you see?" he asked, his voice low.
"I see the future balanced on the edges of a million swords. I see beginning. I see ending.
Will we succeed?"
"Not even the War Master asks that."
She paused again.
"Not even he knows that. The gods hold their breath. And if word is written of what shall come, I cannot read it."
She turned and looked at Lyak.
"Does that give you comfort, Sadu Lyak?"
Her aura was shadowed silver, streaked with cold grey and black. He turned away and began to walk down the ashen path between the pyre cages.
"The sacrifices have been made," he said. "The propitiations are complete. It is time to go."
The fires in the towering iron cages had cooled to embers. The flesh and bones they had held were now just charred tatters and ashes. The scent of cooking meat had faded as the screams had soaked into the warp. 80,000 had died on the plateau, where once the Emperor had stood. Not a true offering, but a promise.
"Atrocity is a necessity sometimes," said Actea, following him. "Half of these idiots would do such things for pleasure."
"That is," began Lyak.
"That is the truth," said Actea. "And what matters in the end is that humanity knows the truth. Everything else was hope and pride."
They reached the ramp of the nearest Stormbird.
Its hull was the crimson of the word-bearers, but the Eye of Horus now marked its flank, branded into it by fire to show its allegiance to the anointed Warmaster of Chaos. He mounted the ramp, but Actea did not follow. Lyak paused at the top and looked back at her. I released the binding on Prince Fulgrim, but I can't remember anything before the journey to find him. I don't know who I am.
Consequences, Ardulak. You were used, but even those who are slaves must pay a price. Everyone does in the end.
Then why do I go on?
Because even without a self, you have faith, she said.
He was silent for a long moment.
Ask, she said.
Lyak felt his cheek twitch inside his mask. It was you, wasn't it? He said. You revealed Lorgar's intention to Horus. Somehow you told him what was planned.
Actea's smile did not alter.
She walked up the ramp until she was standing just in front of him, and then put a hand out and tapped the iron eye of Horus, newly set at the center of his breastplate.
The truth, Zardulaik, is the greatest force in the universe. It is not kind. It is not a shield against cruelty. It is the most dangerous thing you can hold. And it is all that matters.
And the gods?
The gods are a truth, she said.
She dropped her hand from his chest and began to walk back down the ramp. And you? Came the call when she was almost at the bottom. I have talked to half a dozen of the word-bearer's hierarchy. There was no one of your name amongst the oracles of the Ashen Saint. No one of your description or power. Yet there you were, waiting for us on Orcus.
She stopped at the bottom of the ramp, the smile twitching slightly wider beneath her cowl.
She turned her face towards him, blind eyes seeing everything and nothing. Who are you? He asked.
She tilted her head pointedly up at the sky above. You should not delay. Horus awaits your word that the rites are complete, she said. And eternity has waited long enough.
Do the gods truly want us to win?
She let out a breath and brushed a flake of ash from her cheek with a bloodstained finger. The ramp began to lift. The gunship began to rise into the air as the scream of its thrusters built.
Farewell, Zardulaik,
said Actea. And then the sight of her was gone, and he was lifting away into the night sky.
Argonis. The last gunship lifted from the surface of Ullinor, rising through the columns of smoke until it cut into the void above. It flew to the ship that lay at the heart of the cloud of warships waiting above the desecrated world. A hangar bay, high on the command fortress, swallowed it. Argonis waited for it to set down, and then for Zardulaik to descend to the deck. The Crimson Apostle, flanked by his twin slaves, paused at the foot of the ramp. The Eye of Horus gleamed bright on the crimson of the cloak pinned to his back. He bowed his head to Argonis and then looked up.
The libations have been poured. The offerings burned.
Argonis gave a nod of acknowledgement and began his walk to the throne room. He walked alone, his staff of office marking his steps down silent corridors. Human officers and slaves abased themselves as he passed, and legion warriors clenched their fists in salute. His steps rang through the silence until he reached the doors of the throne room. They opened for him without him having to pause. Horus looked up from his place on the throne. Argonis held his own gaze steady as his mind shook. The Mournival stood at the foot of the throne. All of them turned at his entering, cold eyes following him. The chained furnace of the Red Angel burned close to Abaddon. At the edge of sight, Unkari slithered and slid between the pillars, flowing from bloated beauty to wasp-thin terror like mercury. He felt his mind stretch and creak as sensations pulled at his will. He reached the throne, mounted the first step and knelt. Every part of him wanted to never rise, to never look at what sat there.
It is done,
asked Horus.
Yes, sir.
Horus rose. Armor and shadow shook and flowed as he stepped from his throne and descended to stand in front of the great viewport behind it.
Voxlink to all ships, he said.
His eyes were unblinking holes in the fabric of his face.
The link is active, said Argonis.
The hour is here, said Horus.
His voice not raised, but echoing in the ears of millions, all of them waiting for one word. The word that had followed them as a promise of glory, vengeance, and slaughter.
Terror, said the War Master.
Ecadon. Ecadon stood at the center of the training chamber, stripped to the waist, his knife in his hand. The deck around him was clean, scraped and cleansed until the blade marks shone. He felt the walls rumble with the song of engines as the great ship pushed through the tides of the warp. A low sound made him freeze for a second. He smiled. He checked the binding on the medallion of the Cathartidae. It was firm. The stone disc felt warm against his skin. He closed his eyes and flicked the knife from hand to hand. The chamber and shadows were still.
You're losing your touch, he said,
opening his eyes and smiling into the dark. No answer came.
Unless, of course, you wanted me to realize you were here.
A figure stepped into the half-light. He was a legionary, but like Ecadon, he had shed his power armor. A tunic of black carbon fiber weave covered his torso and hung to his knees. Tattoos of birds spread down his exposed arms.
Greetings, Lord Equerry,
said Ecadon, inclining his head.
Callus,
said Argonis, his gaze steady. Ecadon flicked the knife into the air again, caught it, grinned.
The unscarred replaces the twisted. Well, I suppose it makes a sort of sense.
Argonis walked closer, his hands empty and by his sides.
The War Master honors and appreciates all you did. But others do not.
Argonis shook his head.
Kyber and Abaddon, breathed Ecadon. There are limits to forgiveness. Well, they could be dealt with, though, surely. Pride healed, feathers smoothed. A test for your diplomacy and your authority. The unity of the Legion must be maintained.
Ecadon looked at his brother, the grin still in place, but his eyes holding sorrow.
Do you miss it? Chthonia, I mean. The old times. We were children, said Argonis,
stopping 3 paces from Ecadon.
Yes, said Ecadon, grinning wider. Murderous children.
Argonis smiled, the expression cracking the smooth skin of his face. In his eyes, the light of fires in remembered tunnels flared.
Would you?
He had asked, and his blood brother had grinned.
If you were given my death coin, would you do it?
No,
he said, and aimed a light punch at Argonis's shoulder.
Might try, though, just to see.
See what?
Well, if I could do it. If you're really that sharp.
I am.
Well, now I know, don't I?
And their laughter cut the shadows. In the dark of the dueling chamber, at the heart of the vengeful spirit, Argonis took the mirror coin from a pouch at his waist and tossed it into the center of the circle. It fell with a chime of silver, its black face pale and bright against the scarred stone. Ecadon looked at it, and then up at Argonis.
Shall we?
He said. Argonis nodded and stepped forwards.